Right Chamber Podcast.
In every episode, we will talk about pivotal topics relating to medicine and surgery in the UK and what it is like to be a doctor today. We will be inviting doctors across the different specialties to discuss their experiences and give an insight into what their journey has been like.
So sit back,
ignore the traffic,
and enjoy the Right Chamber Podcast. Produced by the Ron Grimley Undergraduate Center.
Welcome to the Right Chamber,
the podcast where we dive deep into the fascinating world of healthcare and medicine.
I'm Dr. Ebby.
And I'm Dr. Shah.
And every week we will bring you insightful conversations from healthcare specialists in the medical field.
Today, we're thrilled to have with us Ms. Soha Sajid, a renowned trauma and orthopedic consultant at the Dudley Group NHS Foundation Trust in the West Midlands.
Okay, so before we dive in, we want to remind you to connect with us on social media. So follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel at RGUC Media for more content and updates.
And we love hearing back from our listeners. So if you have any topic suggestions or if you want to be a guest on our podcast, please drop us an email at media.team@rguc.co.uk.
All right, so let's get started.
So I guess just for our listeners, if you would like to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit more about what you do at Russell's Hall.
Okay, so my name's Soha Sajid. I am a trauma and orthopaedic consultant. I specialise in hand surgery. So I started at the Dudley Group back in September 2021. Just as we were coming out of the COVID pandemic. So my role here is as an orthopaedic surgeon, but also part of my role is to develop hand service and hand surgery services and locally within the Dudley Group. So that was another sort of part of my role when I was appointed.
So I was just going to ask you, what was your journey then starting like your career in surgery?
Sure. So I went to Nottingham, University of Nottingham Medical School. And I think quite early on, I think I much preferred surgery to medicine. Not that I disliked medicine, but I just really liked surgery and this kind of like the surgical field. I quite liked the idea of sort of operating to try and help people get better. Going on into sort of kind of later, like sort of in the fourth, fifth year, I kind of developed a bit of an interest in trauma surgery. So I really liked the idea of, you know, helping people who've undergone trauma and sort of really kind of started looking into that. So I did my elective in Brazil, of all places, in trauma surgery, which is very different to how we perceive trauma surgery. So there it's run by general surgeons. Their trauma is quite different to, well, is similar to ours in the sense that there's a lot of road traffic accidents, etc., but they have a lot of stabbings, gunshot wounds. Gunshot wounds is probably one of their most primary trauma. So, you know, very much a role of the general surgeon. And the general surgeons do pretty much everything from like the neck and the whole of the torso. So that was kind of like my introduction. And then my foundation training, I tried to take jobs which had a bit of a surgical theme to it. So I had an F2 job in Tino, and had general surgery jobs both my first and second year foundation training, and then I managed to get onto core surgical training with a TNO theme because that's what I kind of wanted to do. I also did 4 months of neurosurgery and then 4 months of vascular/general surgery, which I did at Russell's Hall, in fact, and then my CT2 year was again at Russell's Hall. So I did 2 years of being a clinical teaching fellow in the trauma and orthopaedic department here before I got my specialty training. Finished that off and then did my fellowship at Derby, my hand fellowship at Derby, before starting my consultant job here. So yeah, it was a bit of a long-winded ramble.
I feel like that wasn't long-winded at all because right now I feel like doctors just generally do take quite a few years out.
Yeah.
Especially before specialist training.
Definitely.
So I think that's very common now. So yeah. But I guess I The one thing I wanted to ask about was the internship that you did, or the elective. So that was right after med school.
Yes.
So going into a different country and having to sort of go through a system that was entirely new and the different sorts of trauma. So is there any story that sort of stands out? Anything that you remember?
Yes, that was my elective. So at Nottingham, we did our elective after we finished our finals. But yeah, I chose Brazil because I wanted to go somewhere a bit new and a bit challenging. And it was a really wonderful place. I actually got recommended Brazil by when I was doing my GP placement at the start of fifth year. The GP I was with, he was a great guy. He was really interesting. He'd done a lot of traveling. And I was thinking about going to South America. And I thought maybe Peru, and then he was like, oh, no, go to Brazil. Because his wife had lived in Brazil for a period of time. He's like, it's a really great country. And I had a couple of friends when I was at first year who were students, sort of exchange students from Brazil. They were doing like a year at Nottingham. So I kind of made contacts with them. So I had a base to go work on. So it really sprung from there. It was an absolutely fascinating place. Lovely, lovely people. Really kind of welcome you. And from a place which kind of is renowned for gang-related crime. Everybody I met there was thankfully really, really lovely. Really, really nice. There were lots of gunshot wound patients. Their ITU used to be guarded by like armed guards. It was like proper like people with rifles that used to guard the entrance to ITU. You had to be scanned as you went through because they had occasions when people come in and shot people whilst they were in hospital. And they had like a separate wing for people who were specially involved in gang related crime. So they were separated from the sort of the regular patients, but you also had like regular stuff. It's kind of unusual stuff. So people with really random, weird abscesses, because it's a tropical country. So the breadth of their medicine is quite different to what we would sort of normally see. We see like weird and wonderful things just that were not related to any kind of violence or crime or trauma. There's a big variety of things.
I had that one sort of odd incident as well, because I did my foundation year in Pakistan, and in the A&E it serves the same thing, that you get a really different and really sort of trauma patient, sort of a lot of gunshot wounds and a lot of stab wounds. And there was this one patient that had come in with a gunshot wound. And then the person who sort of shot the first bullet also got shot. So we had like the bay sort of curtained off, but then there were two patients that had already been in a fight, just sort of in the A&E next to each other. So as soon as the curtain just sort of goes and then they see each other,
immediate tension.
And in the A&E as well, so I do understand that, but I feel like it was the same for me. Sort of the chaos attracted me towards like trauma and surgery as well. Was there any sort of point where you sort of reconsidered maybe not doing surgery or trauma and orthopedics?
I think I sometimes reconsider not doing medicine. I think it's something that you have to really make it about what you want it to be, and not. And I think even for myself, I think I always had this idea of career. That's all I wanted to focus on. I think in some ways I wish I hadn't just focused on my career and been a lot more kind of laid back about it. Having said that, I am where I am, and I have no regrets in that sense, that I had very good training. I met a lot of really brilliant people, I've got a lot of very good colleagues, not just at this trust, but really at a lot of other trusts that, I'm privileged to know. I think there is less of a demand, and certainly when I was a junior doctor, there was a very sort of, your career, your work was everything that you did. It was a very sort of, this was your life. This is what you do. And that has watered down. And I think that's a good thing, it's watered down. I think some of the older doctors do complain. I think even I find myself sometimes going, it's not how I used to be. It used to be in my era. I think certainly going back to the people who were predecessors to myself, their workload was a lot more intense than what I have experienced. And the sacrifices they make were perhaps more than what I have had to make. I mean, you do make a lot of sacrifices working in medicine anyway. Particularly in a specialty where there is an on-call commitment and there is a demand, you know, commitment.
Do you ever feel like when you're in theatre, like you're struggling with your identity or you lose your identity whilst in that space?
No, I know exactly what you're asking. So I think that is not just to theatre. I think that is a very sort of broad-based question. And I think it's much harder in some ways for women than it is for men. And it's not to belittle men in any way, because they have the same struggles. And, you know, they have the same kind of ladder to climb in many respects. But there is a different sort of expectation to women. And you do have to sort of feel like you're shouting louder to be heard. And you feel like, you know, you're not respected as much as if you were a man. And that is a very, very noted thing. That if you speak to any of my peers, they will say that very, very similar experiences. So we discussed this in some of our WhatsApp groups. So there is an actual thing where, you know, you sit in a trauma meeting and a case has been discussed and you come up with a possible solution or a possible way of fixing the fracture or doing something or managing the patient. And everybody ignores you. And then a guy says the exact same thing. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And it's like, I literally just said that about 5 minutes ago. So there is a lot of that. You do have to sort of shout louder to be heard. I'm not somebody who is, you know, who's one of these kind of like bull in a china shop kind of people at all. However, I've actually met a number of people who I'm still very close to throughout my training, so who were trainers of mine, who actually, they're men, but have very similar personalities to me, though, so they're quite introverted people too. They're not shouty, loud people, but to a degree, because they're men and because they're more senior, maybe they get heard more and maybe it's not as much of a challenge. But I think I've been quite... I've taken a lot of sort of encouragement from the fact that they weren't loud, shouty people to be very successful surgeons. And again, like me, they are hand surgeons. So, you know, they're kind of people I've kind of naturally have an inclination to. And I still, you know, even to this day, I still work with them. So it's like birds of a feather flock together. So you will find people that that have shared interests or likes or personalities to yourself, which will be a source of comfort. So, you know, every cloud has a silver lining, every hardship has ease, and you will find that in life. So when you feel a little bit like, well, you know, nobody's listening to me, nobody's respecting me, I think you just have to really kind of take stock and know that you're the person who is the captain of the ship, and you have to direct the ship. It has to be something that has to come from yourself. There is a lot of, and again, I'm not a naturally very confident person either. If you just have that confidence in yourself, it's not like confidence is a very I think there's a kind of people who are confident are like arrogant, you know, very bold, quite. But there's a quiet confidence that you have to harness. Okay, I'm in charge here. This is what you have to do, and also not compromise. I think that's something that becoming a consultant certainly, and as you got towards being a more senior trainee, you were saying you felt you had more of a right to say, no, I won't accept this. I do want it like this. Or there's a certain degree of negotiation that needs to be done to a degree. But you have to be like, no, this is what I want. This is what we need to do.
The next question, maybe you've already highlighted some, but are there any sort of unique challenges during your training or, I guess, being a consultant that you think that you might want to highlight or the listeners might benefit from?
I think for women, I think my advice would be, don't worry about if you have to go into less than full-time training. I mean, I haven't. I've always been full-time. I think the thing I would do is encourage women particularly to not feel like they have to put off having a family or, you know, having that aspect of their life. That is something I'd encourage people to do. I wouldn't say to people, you know, just focus on your career, because it is a lot more challenging for women compared to men, because if you've got kids and you're the mom, it's a very different role to if you're the dad in many respects. A lot of dads are now a lot more hands-on than they were. So, for example, my father's a surgeon, and there were periods of our childhood where he was barely around because he was working, and he worked really long hours. And mom was effectively, she was a housewife, so she took care of myself and my two siblings. So that, you know, we grew up in a very traditional household in that respect. But mom took care of us, our day-to-day thing. So if she worked, it would have been quite difficult. Things have changed a lot more now. So fathers are a lot more hands-on. They're a lot more involved in the day-to-day taking care of children. So it's a lot about balancing family life. So don't be afraid to delve into that. And I think the newer generation that are coming up are kind of more aware of that and are more used to that. That's the norm. It wasn't so much in my day. It's now becoming that, but it wasn't so much in my day. So I would say definitely it's something that I would sort of encourage women to do, and also encourage people, you know, not just women but men too. If you want to do other things in your life, there is a scope for that too. Not everybody wants to just do a very clinically based job, which, you know, for me suits me because that's what I enjoy. Some people really like to do research. Some people really like to be involved in a kind of managerial section. Some people have a much more business head, and they have a natural aptitude to that, which is great. So there's only 24 hours in the day. So if you're happy to accept what you've got, then I wouldn't worry about about having other avenues to your work.
What's encouraging is, like, I feel like a lot of people, when we go into medicine or surgery, we kind of go tunnel vision, isn't it? And literally just told us, actually, the world's your oyster, like, go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was very tunnel visioned, which is fine. And I think you don't realise when you're young. I think you're very driven. And it's only when you get older, maybe, you kind of think, oh, maybe I should have been less tunnel vision. And hindsight is a wonderful thing. It's all right to do other aspects, other things, as a kind of a sideline. It's really kind of you looking to see what is, you might have heard of the whole ikigai concept of, you know, what the world needs, what you're good at, and what will earn you money, the overlapping circles. I think you do have to keep those kind of ideas in mind when you're looking at your career, because life is busy and you will get sucked and drawn into it. So you do have to be quite mindful of not being sort of too absorbed in one thing.
Yeah, right now I struggle with just reading a book. So I start reading a book And then I'm just like,
any best.
10 pages in, and then I buy another book. So they just pile on my bedside table. And then I just never get to them. And that is my life, just work.
I know, I've got like a whole heap of books that I've bought that I really wanted to read. Ironically, the last book I bought was about, you know, the 5-2 diet by the late Michael Mosley. And thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to read this, I'm going to lose lots of weight, I'm going to become really healthy. And yeah, that just has not happened at all.
I struggled to convince myself to go to the gym every day.
We struggle.
Yeah, every day. It's like, Abby, do you want to go? Never like, oh, do you want to go?
No. And I think, again, health is a real important thing to look after during your career, because we do work really long hours. We work shifts, so we do nights and things like that, which are not good for our bodies at all. So you do have to look after your, look after your health, both your physical health and your mental health. Because again, there's a lot of mental health problems within the medical profession, which is really quite a sad thing, given that this is where, you know, we're meant to be helping people, but we can not help ourselves. Physical health is something that always takes a back seat, always on the back burner. The last thing you do want to do is sort of be like, okay, I am going to stop and have lunch rather than eat on my way from one clinic to the next. You do have to sort of just slow it down a little bit sometimes.
Tomorrow I'm just going to be in my bed and eating a bag of crisps.
I'm definitely big on
as well, so you know, but it's so important, and I've heard quite a few people talk about it, especially.
If you look at sort of the rates of heart disease, diabetes amongst doctors, it's like sky high, really sky high, because we don't look after ourselves.
We feel like we don't have the time.
It is, and I think the one thing I've kind of has become lately in the last couple of years, especially since I've started my consultant job, really kind of saying, okay, I need to invest time in certain areas which I haven't been investing time in. Your career does take a big chunk of it. And that's what it was always about, you know, the job, the career, you know, completing training, you know, one ARCP to the next ARCP to the next exam to the next, next kind of hurdle or the next, you know, mountain to climb. But you have to also make time for other things. So you really do have to make time for your health and well-being, your relationships, because otherwise it will pass you by.
I haven't called my mum in like a week, maybe.
I'll
head out and call her and be like,
and do things on the side, you know, have hobbies. One of my hobbies is I have a private pilot's license. And having said that, I haven't flown for ages, and I need to get back onto doing it. But it's just trying to make the time to do it, because it is a big time investment. So you don't necessarily have to take up flying, but take up some hobby which gets you out of the medical profession. So one of the consultants that I worked with at Derby, he did a lot of sailing, which is, you know, a great hobby to do. Gets you out and about. There's a few consultants that I know, one particular consultant I worked with, he did a lot of running and like fell walking and things like that. So you need to do something that will get you out of the hospital kind of environment, because you need to have that balance.
It feels like that's a really big balance that you have.
But that's what I honestly don't. it's all a facade. I say these things, but I really rarely get a chance to do them. But you do have to enjoy the other things and the other things in life. It doesn't have to be a massively expensive or invested hobby. You know, some people like to scuba dive, other people like to just go out for a walk in the countryside. They're all very, it's about what puts your mind at ease, more than anything.
Top tip. Yeah, so that is really cool. Thank you. That's cool. Yeah. Actually, speaking about like just future doctors coming in, like what advice would you have for those coming in who've actually like faced barriers? Because you mentioned that, you know, you didn't get your numbers straight away. So, you know, there's going to be multiple barriers. Like how would...
Yeah. So when I was applying for specialty training, it was the era where it was massively competitive, like massively. And so, yeah, initially I wasn't sixth. It was only my third attempt, I got it. And I still, to this day, I'm still completely astounded that I did get it. I think you just have to have that, the resilience to kind of, even if things are not working out, to, if you've got lemons, make lemonade, you have to sort of see the bright side and then work a way around it. And it is quite demoralizing when things don't go your way. I was lucky in where I got to, and it's only, again, with hindsight that I can see actually maybe if I'd got a number straight away, I wouldn't have had such a good experience as I have had. So there's always, you might not be able to see it at the time, but don't lose hope. I think our working pattern is going to have to change in the future. It has already changed to what it was before. I think it will continue to change in the future. I remember when I was a fifth year medical student, one of the consultants saying that the job's getting harder. And this is back, going back to, 2006, I think, when I first started fifth year. So I remember him sort of saying that, and this is going, a long time ago now. He was right. Things are getting tougher for us. And because we don't have the luxury of having worked as much as our predecessors have, if you look at my logbook compared to a consultant who's 20 years senior to me, there's going to be a massive disparity. But then if you look at somebody who is starting now, their logbook compared to my logbook at their stage, there's going to be a huge difference too. So it is getting harder and harder to get that training. It is getting harder and harder to get that experience. And that's true because we're working different hours. So it's becoming tougher in many ways on us. And that's something that has to be recognised and has to be sort of, we have to kind of think of ways of how to help ourselves. So there's a lot of work being done in simulation. There's a lot of work being done on human factor training and training in a kind of like a simulated environment to try and help people increase their experience and skills. I think those things will probably become more evident in the future because it's becoming more and more, yeah, more tough. And it's hard for junior doctors now when you see them in theatre. Compared to what I was able to do when I was a junior doctor, they probably get given a lot less because the time pressures are so much. Their skills are probably not as refined as what trainees back then might have had. So it's becoming harder and harder for them to get good training. So that's going to have to change, unfortunately, in the future. I don't know quite how, but I suspect things will kind of evolve.
I think maybe at our stage as well, a lot of people are they're starting to look at other countries and other avenues that they can take as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't know if at any point did you ever consider not working in the NHS or in the UK, maybe going to a different country, because I feel like it's very popular with us.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are going abroad. I did for sort of a brief period of time and think, it'd be quite nice to take I never got to take a gap year, and I kind of feel like I've owed a gap year somewhere. And I feel like, maybe I should go work, go and do like a sort of a fellowship, particularly in hands or something like that, in a place where they do, super specialist surgery or something like that. I think it's also that there's a lot of there's a lot less of a taboo now of going abroad than there was before. So say taboo, it's, it used to be like, you know, if you go abroad, you're kind of setting yourself back 2 years in your career for the year you spent out. And that's becoming a bit less of a bit less of an issue. So I think it's probably it's worth looking into. Quite what experience you get may be varied depending on where you go. I think it's becoming a lot easier to then get back into the NHS, having been out. I think it used to be a bit harder. So yeah, no, I'd love to go abroad and see things. That's, you know, like, you know, there's various hand things that I would like to go and see, and, you know, in the Far East or in, you know, Australia, New Zealand, or, you know, other, you know, other places. And I'd love to be able to do some charity work in places which are, you know, need, desperately need, just as a way of giving back, just as a way of kind of helping humanity. But I appreciate that's not an easy thing to do. And I haven't quite worked out how I can do that, because,
especially as a surgeon.
Yeah.
You need a team.
Well, it's you can work with an organization, you know, there are different organizations that go abroad. So, you know, MSF, Red Cross, MAP, you know, they do work abroad. Trying to take time out from your, as a consultant, can be quite tricky. And also you've got your patients here too, which, particularly when, you know, you've got somebody sitting across the table from you going, oh, doctor, you're the only one that can help me. And this is in Dudley. Then you kind of feel like, oh gosh, okay. That's not necessarily true. I'm sure that there are many people that can help, but you've got there's a local population too that I feel like a responsibility to. So, and then you've got your family that you don't necessarily want to uproot, or, you know, the problems that you would get. So it's something maybe looking into doing in shorter bursts rather than taking a whole year out. Maybe looking to do in shorter things. So I would definitely encourage people to do that.
In my experience, obviously I'm not like at a consultant level, but generally, sometimes patients ask if I'm a doctor or not, or they may request to see someone else just because, you know, I am tiny. I understand that. But
trust me, I've had this all throughout my career. I still have it now, where you go and see a patient and you're like, oh, the nurse is here to see me. You're like, I'm not a nurse. No disrespect to nurses. And there is a lot of that. There is this assumption that if you're a woman, you're not a doctor, or you're not a senior doctor. And that stays, you know, I've seen so many patients where you're like, oh yeah, thank you, nurse. And I'm like, yeah, I just fixed your femur, you know. Not a nurse. But that's a very, very common thing. And that's the experience of all my female colleagues. Men don't get that same kind of assumption. I don't hear any male colleagues ever saying, oh, you know, patient thought I was a nurse, because there is a gender bias when it comes to a doctor role, and particularly a surgeon role too. That, you know, this it's that joke of, you know, well, not that joke, but that kind of, you know, a boy had an accident, and both him and his father are brought in, and the surgeon goes, I cannot operate on him, he's my son. And it's because, and you're like, it makes you think, oh, it's because the surgeon's a female, his surgeon's his mum. So, you know, it's kind of, you take the assumption that the surgeon's going to be his father. Whereas it's, you know, it's not the case so all the time. But yeah, that's a very, very common thing. Maybe it'll change as generations to come. But I still, I mean, you think maybe it's just older people, but sometimes it's relatively young people too. So
put my name tag on.
Yeah.
To say it's Dr. Sean.
Yeah.
And I just sort of hope that they read it and I don't have to correct
them. No, interestingly, my senior consultant, when I worked at Ellsworth Street, he never used to introduce me by my first name. When I was his junior and I was working as his registrar, he'd always introduce me as Miss Sargent. So, you know, which I really respect for him for doing that. So, yeah.
So I guess just to sort of summarize and end it all, are there any specific role models that you've looked up to becoming a surgeon or a trauma and orthopedic surgeon? And what sort of things did you take from them when you were training?
We all have role models. And to this day, I still have, you know, some colleagues of mine, male and female, that I kind of think, oh, you know, that's the sort of person I wouldn't want to try and be because of positive things that they have done, or, you know, good characteristics that they have displayed, or, you know, certain things that they have sort of, they're the way that they are. And that you think, okay, you know, that's something that I would like to, you know, that's a good practice. I would like to do that. So I think that's a really, really important thing. I think for women in particular, you do look for, you know, everybody looks for an identity. I think they're now making Barbie dolls of different, you know, different ethnicities, professions, you know, which I think is a really great thing, because when I was a kid, you know, all Barbie dolls looked the same. Or it doesn't have to be a Barbie doll, any kind of doll, look the same, because that's what kind of children play with, and they want to, you know, they want to see all characters in, you know, in a TV program or in a cartoon that they can identify with. So there is, you do want to have sort of people that you can identify with. I think when I was starting, as I said, there was relatively fewer women in surgery. I remember myself and a friend of mine who one or two friends of mine who also wanted to be surgeons, us going to see one of the orthopedic surgeons at Nottingham. This is going back probably almost 20 years ago now. makes me feel really old. And going up to sort of go up to see her. And she was really, really nice. She was really encouraging. And I think you do need sort of role models like that, where, you know, you've got sort of women who have been quite encouraging. I remember when I was in F1, my educational supervisor was this really bolshy African-Caribbean lady who was a breast surgeon. And like literally everybody was scared, everyone was scared of her. Like, she was formidable, this woman. And I was her sort of appointed trainee, and I kind of going up to her going, oh god, this is gonna be really scary. And she was so nice to me, and she found out I wanted to be a surgeon, she was like, oh, that's brilliant. And she was really, really encouraging, and I think that's a sort of thing, you know, you want to try and reciprocate back. I think you want to try and said that kind of encouraging vibe. I think the negative vibe that used to exist in medicine, which still exists to this day, is something that does need to be kind of hammered out a bit, because there are people who can be quite negative and quite condescending. But you want to have that kind of positive vibe, because it does make a big difference as to how people view you. And how people view themselves. So it's the whole kind of, you know, lift as you climb analogy. You do want to send a very good vibe. And at the same time, you look towards people, and you will find those people there, men and women. You will find those people there if you look. It's just about, you know, coming across the right person at the right time. Which will happen. It inevitably always does.
Yeah. I feel like it's mainly the same for us. I don't know if it's the same for Abby, but a lot of people that I talk to, it doesn't have to be surgery, but just any specialty, if I show an interest, it's generally mostly negative.
Yeah.
They tend to tell you that it's going to be hard and maybe consider something else. And I understand that because we do need to be realistic as well and have realistic expectations. But it's not great when it's sort of based on the fact that maybe women cannot really do surgery or maybe take a less competitive field, even if that's what you're interested in.
You will come across people who are quite positive. And I think there's a certain thing about the way you feel about yourself and the way that you give, you attract the same vibe. So don't ever feel negative about yourself. And if you do come, and you will come across negativity, because that's part of life. I think just sort of, yeah, consider it. I think it's something that you do need to be mindful of and think about the challenges. I think that's well worth sort of thinking about. But any challenge always has a way around it. You know, Mount Everest gets climbed. So if you know, we sent a man to the moon. You know, things are difficult, not necessarily impossible. And as I said, life has a way of working itself out. And yeah, sometimes you may feel, you know, and sometimes women take a break for their families, or they may step back from their career and have taken sort of a role which is not as sort of intense. And I think sometimes those women feel very negative about themselves, but I don't think they should. I think that serves a very important role in itself. Somebody once mentioned, so back in, you know, the time where I'm just mentioning about putting a man on the moon, back in the time when, you know, the whole kind of space race was going on, and that, you know, this was a huge thing. So, you know, people at NASA were working like literally 24/7. So there was a group of sort of scientists and developers and who you know, whatever their roles were working late into the night to get a particular mission up and running and started. And they left really, really late at night. I think they were leaving at something ridiculous, like, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning. And there was a cleaner there cleaning. And they were like, you know, we're leaving late, but why are you here? You know, why are you cleaning? And he's like, why are you working? He's like, oh no, I'm working to help put a man on the moon. So that was his role. And that role is just as important because we need a clean environment to be able to work. So everybody has a place to play. And I don't think anybody's role should ever be belittled, because it is just as important. That team can't function if that person is not there. So there's nothing that to say that I'm more important than you. It's just that I do a more kind of, I guess, a more kind of high demand area of work than somebody else might do. That's because I've chosen it to be there. It doesn't make me any better a person. It doesn't make me any less of a person. It doesn't make them any better or less of a person either. It's just a part of the structure.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree. That was nice. That was beautiful. Yep.
Thank you. And I think that's it. So that brings us to the end of this episode of The Right Chamber.
Yeah. So we really hope that you enjoyed the conversation today. It was absolutely valuable. And it's just brought us some more insight into medicine and surgery.
And a huge thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's my pleasure. My absolute pleasure.
And sharing your experiences with us as well.
So I just wanted to say, remember to stay connected with us on social media. So follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGECMS, and subscribe to our YouTube channel at RGEC Media for more exclusive content and updates.
And again, if you have any suggestions, or if you feel like you would like to be a guest on our podcast, you can send us an email at media.team@rguc.co.uk.
Okay, so thank you for joining us at The Right Chamber. So until next time.
The Right Chamber podcast, produced by the Ron Grimley Undergraduate Center.